Morning, everyone. In the matter of State versus Donnell Gideon, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Deputy Attorney General, Acting Assistant Prosecutor Linda A. Shashua, on behalf of the state.
Alan Dexter Bowen, on behalf of Donnell Gideon.
Stephen A. Yomtov, Deputy Attorney General for the Attorney General's Office, Amicus Curiae.
Thank you, Mr. Yomtov, for agreeing to appear telephonically. We've had some difficulty with the video equipment, and we appreciate your going with us. Ms. Shashua, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
This case is about a misapplication of settled law. We ask this court to reverse the appellate division's grant of a new trial for two reasons, either of which justifies reversal. First, the appellate division's failure to defer to the PCR court's supported credibility findings makes the PCR evidentiary hearing superfluous. And second, the appellate division's failure to consider the overwhelming evidence of guilt unduly expanded this court's strength of evidence benchmark set forth in Pierre. The appellate division erred by essentially creating new PCR standards for review in the denial of defendant's PCR, reversing that denial. By isolating basically one phrase from one proffered witness and disregarding everything that the PCR court found made that witness not credible and even damaging to defendant's alibi, the appellate division has misapplied the prejudice standard in this case. It is not the role of the appellate division to cherry pick from defendant's proffer, to disregard credibility assessments made by the PCR court from live testimony, and to ignore the full context of the evidence. Here, that compelling evidence was undervalued, which is the necessary backdrop to any assessment of prejudice. The defendant confessed to being an accomplice to murder. That was corroborated by an uninvolved eyewitness who knew the defendant. That was corroborated by the ballistics evidence and by a strong motive. Defendants should also have faced an uphill battle, given that up until his cross-examination testimony at trial, he never mentioned an alibi. He didn't mention it in his statement to the police. He didn't mention it in his Miranda hearing testimony. And he didn't even mention it on direct examination at his trial. It wasn't a
process. Can I ask you to hold for a second?
Please.
I'm going to ask everyone again to please mute if you're not speaking. That includes counsel. We're having some noise issues. Please go ahead.
Thank you. It wasn't until cross-examination when the jury, along with defendant's counsel, heard for the first time that he claimed to be at home with his mother, at his mother's house, alone with his girlfriend that night. It wasn't until 8 years after the homicide and 5 years after trial that he proffered the mother and girlfriend as alibi witnesses. The problem the PCR court properly recognized was that both belated witnesses actually contradicted defendant's prior trial testimony. Both defendant's mother and defendant's girlfriend claimed that defendant's mother was home with them. Not only did that make defendant's alibi testimony an impossibility, but also a litany of other contradictions made it not credible to PCR court properly. Particularly in the face of undeniably overwhelming evidence, that should not win a trial. In a case like Pierre, nothing those alibi witnesses would have testified to would have hurt the defendant's alibi, even if they were not fully believed. They would have reinforced defendant's alibi. Here, 90% of what the witnesses would say make defendant a liar. The omission of such evidence not be said to undermine the confidence in the outcome of the trial. And when weighed against the compelling guilt here as opposed to the sparse evidence in Pierre, the attorney error of not seeking a recess is far less significant. While the appellate division read Pierre to say that a reviewing court should not focus on the non-fundamental of a defendant's PCR proffer. The court erred here by disregarding the stark contradictions recognized by the PCR court between the defendant's girlfriend and mother saying they were all home together and defendant testifying under oath that he was home alone with his girlfriend. This is not a non-fundamental point. It's the heart of the alibi, his whereabouts. Finally, the problem in this case is that the appellate division has opened the
door to... Ms. Shashua, hold for a moment. It looks like we lost Mr. Bowman.
Chief, I'm getting feedback. I'm hearing someone's...
As am I.
Your Honor?
Tom?
Sir,
yes.
Does Mr. Yontov have his phone? It sounds like it might be coming from the cell phone.
Right.
I believe the issue would be Mr. Bowman is calling on a phone, but also has his iPhone on. So when he puts the volume down on his iPhone, there won't be feedback.
The iPhone is all the way down. The volume's on.
Great. Okay.
Mr. Yontov, are you there?
I'm here, Your Honor. I just had to unmute my phone. My phone has been muted the whole time.
Let's proceed. Ms. Shashua, please go ahead.
Thank you. Almost done. Finally, the problem in this case is that the appellate division opened the door to new trials virtually every time a defendant presents a mere kernel of support within a proffer years later, no matter what else. If there was prejudice in these circumstances, where the alibi witnesses contradict the defendant's own alibi testimony, where the PCR judge found those witnesses not credible, and where the overwhelming evidence of guilt includes a detailed confession, then the prejudice prong would always be satisfied. These combined errors and the parsing it took to reach the decision require reversal.
Counsel, the appellate division said that the discrepancy as to whether defendant's mother was at home or was at work, quote, has no bearing on Bay, the girlfriend's testimony. Is that correct?
No, I think that you have to look at the context, the full context of what the defendant proffered before the court. I mean, on the one hand, I think I agree that the mother's testimony is not valuable. It's impossible that she could have known his whereabouts, given that defendant testified that she dropped him off, went to work. But the girlfriend said the exact same thing. So by the mother, you negate the girlfriend also. It makes no sense to negate one without the other. And certainly the jury would hear all of that, and the PCR court did. And
not necessarily. Yeah. The defendant could have put just Miss Bay on. The defendant was not required to put Miss Bay and the mother on. So I think this is the point that the chief was getting to. Is the outcome, from your point of view, any different if just Miss Bay were called as a witness?
Only slightly. I think her testimony still fails all on its own. But I think the mother makes it worse.
Can we agree with Shashua what the appellate division did is they engaged in their own credibility findings, disregarding the PCR court's credibility findings and the fact that they had no opportunity to observe the witnesses, consider any other factors that finders of fact find? Basically, they did their own credibility findings and disagree with the appellate court, and that's how they came to this ruling. Is that
exactly
correct?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And I think... You know, the issue here, it wasn't like they found clear error. That's within their purview. They didn't find clear error in the PCR court's findings. What they did was they said, we don't agree with how you assess that, those findings. And that's exactly the substitution of judgment that this court against.
Let me ask you about the principle you would like to see this court adopt here. I understand your argument is there's a distinction between this case and Pierre insofar as the witnesses in Pierre, while there was an issue with dates and so forth in the certifications, did not contradict the defendant's own account of what occurred, whereas the mother in this case contradicted the defendant's own account of what occurred. Are you asking for a statement of principle that if the defendant's alibi testimony is contradicted by a proffered alibi witness, then you can't meet the second prong of Strickland and Fritz? Or should courts look at these issues on their facts without bright-line rules essentially restricting their view of how it should come out?
I would probably say the latter is fair. I think the system worked really well under Pierre. Pierre was very clear, and the idea is that you're looking to see whether it would change the outcome of the case. You gave us a strength of evidence benchmark to use. And I think we don't have to focus on one particular detail ruining the whole case. For instance, certifications in this case both said 2007. They're off by 3 years. No one was really holding that against, you know, clearly a clerical error, kind of like the off by one day in Pierre. But yeah, if it's damaging to the alibi, if every statement but one makes the defendant a liar, I don't think you need a bright line rule for that to say that this is not helpful.
But Pierre did not set forth a new rule of law. It applied Strickland to a set of facts. We're still governed by prong two, the prejudice prong, in which the defendant has to show whether there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional error as a result of the proceedings would have been different. Do you agree?
I do, yes. Yes, Your Honor. And I don't think this is what earlier in the case, it seems like the argument was, well, we shouldn't have to establish prejudice. And in fact, the PCR court at one point said, we don't reach prejudice. This is not one of those chronic expansion cases as we learned in Pierre. So prejudice still affirmatively proved by the defendant. And the deficiency of this case does not equate to prejudice. And that's the argument, that the idea here is that the girlfriend, if called, would have increased
Joshua?
The life. Yes.
We lost Mr. Bowman again. Please wait.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Bowman, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. And now video should be back on shortly. I think that it's in repair.
It's cut off.
Thank you. Hello. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I think there's some support also in State versus Allegro, where the alibi witnesses there were found not to support the defendant's alibi. They directly contradict his trial testimony that the defendant testimony presented that he was driving a blue truck, whereas the alibi was he was driving a white truck. And the court there recognized that the absence of those witnesses could not have created a reasonable probability that but for counsel's failure to investigate, the result would have been different. That's the same analysis. All of this is still under Strickland, and I don't think a new rule is needed.
Ms. Shoshua, you mentioned earlier that the proffered witnesses did not come forward until 5 years after trial. And with regard to Ms. Bay, the girlfriend, her certification does not even assert that she approached counsel at any time prior during trial with her willingness to advance an alibi for defendant. How does that factor into what the appellate division did in disregarding the credibility findings of the PCR court?
Exactly. It factors in because, again, the appellate division was ignoring the full context that the PCR court had before it when it was assessing credibility. And that's a very important factor. When did the witnesses come forward? Apparently, the girlfriend claimed that she was sitting in court through the whole trial, same with the mom. They never came up after, even after the first exchange. The PCR court found attorney's counsel credible when he testified, I had months of meeting with the mom and the defendant. Nobody raised this. And after the defendant kind of landed the bombshell on his cross-examination testimony, Nobody came up to him after, and that was credited by the PCR court. So I think, it informs the totality of the circumstances that the PCR court had before it when it made its detailed credibility findings that the girlfriend was not credible.
Did the PCR court make findings that the mother was not credible? The mother said, I had this conversation with defense counsel, and I told him that we were all together that evening. So did the PCR court ever make a credibility finding concerning that statement?
Yes. The PCR judge, who was also the trial judge, specifically rejected the mother's testimony, found her not credible in specifically on that evidence, and found the trial counsel credible on that same point, that the mother never said anything to her.
In your petition appendix, I believe you point that out at page 153, that you found her testimony, the court found her testimony unbelievable, and that she had never approached counsel as a potential witness. Is that the citation to the transcript that you're referring to, or to the PCR finding?
Yes, and I believe it's also PSA 127 about there in the PCR court opinion itself.
Thank you. And is a similar finding made by the PCR court in the second PCR with regard to Ms. Bay?
I believe because the girlfriend never represented that she did talk to counsel, so that never came up. But the findings there are PSA 128 regarding the girlfriend.
Thank you.
And one last thing about the mom. The mom said that she never even met the defense trial counsel until the day of trial. That was also rejected.
Are there other questions anyone has?
No.
Ms. Shashua, anything you'd like to add? We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Yanto.
Thank you, Your Honor. Do you hear me okay?
We can. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. Okay. The Attorney General's concern in this case is twofold. First, applying and upholding the deferential standard to a PCR court's credibility determinations is critical. This case is a perfect example of an appellate court substituting its own findings because it did not agree with the PCR court's credibility findings concerning defendant's alibi witnesses who only first came to light, and this is important, during the defendant's cross-examination at trial and years after his arrest. The untimeliness of these alibi witnesses should have raised a red flag concerning their veracity, but that was ignored by the panel. The second concern of the Attorney General is applying and upholding Strickland's prejudice standard to ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and not the panel's expansion of the strength of the evidence test as set forth in State versus Pierre. The panel has effectively created a paradigm where prejudice can be established in virtually any case which is not supported by overwhelming evidence of guilt. Nevertheless, both the state and the Attorney General submit that defendant's convictions were supported by strong evidence, if not overwhelming evidence of guilt. Here, both defendant's detailed and corroborated confession and an eyewitness placed in at the scene of the shooting. And also keep in mind, in Pierre, there was no confession, and the alibi was timely, which are critical differences between the two cases. And strength of the evidence, while important to the prejudice analysis, cannot be the sole focus, as the panel seemed to suggest, because that invites appellate courts, and this is important, to make factual and credibility judgments, which is not its role, and exactly what happened in this case. The panel inappropriately and wrongly assessed Bay's credibility. The panel ignored that Bay's testimony was in lockstep with defendant's mother's testimony, who was completely discredited when she testified at the PCR hearing that she was at home on the night of the shooting, which was a complete contradiction to defendant's trial testimony that she dropped him off at home and went to work. Rather, the proper standard and focus is fully set forth in Strickland, that it's defendant's burden on PCR to prove that counsel's deficient performance undermine confidence in the outcome to a reasonable degree of probability. Here, if Bay had testified that she was at home with defendant and his mother on the night of the shooting, but defendant had already testified that his mother went to work, as the PCR court correctly found, it would have substantially increased the likelihood that the jury would not have believed any of the defense witnesses and thus would have increased the likelihood of defendant's convictions. So under these circumstances, post-conviction relief was properly denied and the appellate division judgment should be reversed.
Hold for a second, Mr. Yomtov.
Sure.
Mr. Bowman, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm good. The video is coming back on shortly as well.
I know that it's your video is coming on in and out during the course of the argument. We'll proceed. You'll let us know if you would prefer that we not do so. Would that be all right?
If I could just give me 30 seconds, Your Honor.
And for those who are watching who haven't seen one of our arguments, we've had practically 24 of these, and this seems to be our lucky day. They've gone smoothly up until now.
It appears to have decided that it doesn't want to function, so in the interest of moving forward, I'll just go with the audio, I suppose.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Mr. Yomtov, please proceed.
Oh, I was finished with my opening. I'll, you know, if you have any questions, Your Honor.
I have one question, Mr. Yomtov. Once the defendant on cross-examination mentioned that he was at home, Miss Bay, do you think that created some expectation in the minds of the jury that if this is an alibi, then where is Miss Bay? And that put some pressure on the defendant to produce Miss Bay?
Well, no. I think that once he said that, you know, I think that goes more towards, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that goes more towards the first prong of Strickland, that, you know, it fell upon counsel at that point to, you know, as the PCR court found, to at least ask for an adjournment so that he could find out what's going on and contact Ms. Bay and see if she could corroborate what he was saying. But that's the whole point of the court rule, you know, and that is to give everybody a chance to respond to, okay. You know.
So let me see if I understand your position. Okay, well. Once we vault the deficiency prong, your position is even if defense counsel had an opportunity to speak with Miss Bay, weighing the contradictions between what she would have testified to against what the defendant testified to would have led to the defense counsel not putting her on the stand? Is that your position?
I'm sorry, what was that last word? That he would not have put her on the stand?
Yeah. It's unlikely that he would have, or do you think you don't have to even reach that issue?
I don't think you need to reach that issue, but, you know, see, the problem with this case is that we're looking at everything in hindsight after a PCR hearing, and if you look at it in real time, you know, it, you know, conceding the point that counsel should have at least asked for an adjournment, we probably would have gotten a better answer as to what Bay would have testified to, but Bay didn't come forward, or defendant didn't proffer their certifications until years later. I mean, I think the first PCR hearing wasn't until 2012-2013. So I want to focus, and this is the problem with the active opinion. It really didn't get into the timeliness aspect of it, and that if it had been timely proffered, then as in Pierre, I think it would have, you know, would have given it some more would have tended to be more believable. But by all this passage of time, it really becomes questionable. And If I could just answer an earlier question that was asked of Ms. Shashua, you know, when you look at the mother's testimony, it has to be viewed in the same context as Bay's testimony, because when you have two people, it's not just one person saying something against another where they're diametric opposed. You have two alibi witnesses who are in sync, and both are contradicting what defendants said at trial. So I don't think you could just put the mother's testimony over to one side. You have to consider it. And since the cat is out of the bag, as you know, as we know that expression, the fact that we now know that the mother would testify that she was at home with them, which is in complete contradiction, there's nothing that could prevent the state from calling the mother as a rebuttal witness to refute that defendant is, you know, he's not telling the truth here.
Mr. Yomtov, I'm not sure why you need to go that far, and follow up on Justice Albin's question. Suppose that very afternoon Ms. Bay had taken the stand. We know from the record that exists now that the jury would have heard these two stories. The defendant said, I was home, and I was home with just one person, not my mom, my girlfriend. And then Ms. Bay would have taken the stand and testified, I was with the defendant, but there were two of us with him that night, mom as well. Isn't that a significant matter that would bear on the prejudice prong?
Absolutely. That's our primary argument, that is a fundamental point and that goes to both general credibility as well as substance of what they're testifying to. That you have here a witness who is, meaning they, who is saying that there were three people at the home instead of the two, as you just pointed out. And it also goes to the substance. I mean, how can... If he said the mother went to work and Bay is saying that she was at home, you know, it goes to the heart of what the person is testifying to. And I think if this was in front of the jury, they just would not have believed it, his version.
Other questions for Mr. Yomtov, anyone? Mr. Yomtov, anything else?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Bowman?
Hey, please, the court. Good afternoon. Good morning, Your Honors. One of the things that stands out here from my perspective, particularly when both prosecutors make statements relative to deference to findings of the PCR court, I think there's a complication or a difference in this particular case than in other cases when one refers to the PCR court. There's only one judge who had, of the many judges who've had an opportunity to review this case, who actually met Ms. Bay, and that's Judge Natale. And from my perspective, Judge Natale is the PCR court. He initially, when the PCR was initially filed, it was denied, and there was no hearing conducted, and Judge Natale said, he believed that the failure to call alibi witnesses was a strategic decision, and Mr. Gideon was without recourse. The Appellate Division reversed because they read the entire record and they saw, relative to the alibi witness, particularly Ms. Bay, that had she testified, that there was a substantial possibility that the result would have been different because her testimony was consistent with the testimony of Mr. Gideon, and that is that he was home all night with her, and from her perspective, she was home all night with him. And so that matter, he grants PCR at some point, even though he, what you might call, disparages the witnesses to some degree. But what is significant here, and the crux of what the defense has been trying to communicate throughout this case, is that there was no failure of second prong satisfaction in this particular case. What Judge Natale found, and he heard, he's the only jurist in this case who heard Ms. Bay and heard the mother. He found that whether he would have believed her or not if he were a juror, and whether he would have acquitted her is one thing. But the next issue, and the most significant one,
is whether or not a jury may have acquitted Mr. Gideon and may have viewed Ms. Bay's testimony differently than perhaps Judge Natale did in his commentary. But notwithstanding his assessment of the testimony, the credibility of it, and that sort of thing, he made a firm and unequivocal judgment that a jury should make a decision with respect to whether or not this evidence is substantial and truthful. And when he made his decision relative to what the violation was from the trial lawyer, he said that he deprived the trial lawyer because he didn't do anything, didn't investigate after he heard in open court that there was a witness. He deprived Mr. Gideon of an opportunity to have a jury hear this evidence. And whatever you want to say about Judge Natale's opinion and his methodology and the structure of his arguments, he's absolutely correct in the concept that this is a jury question in this context, whether or not Ms. Bay was believable. Now, let's talk about Ms. Bay, which is something else. The state has diligently avoided talking about. What was it about Ms. Bay that they could have attacked in her personal life otherwise? This is an impeccable woman, other than the fact that people might say, well, she had a relationship with what appears to have been a fellow who maybe is the greatest guy in the world. But there was no attack that could be made on her credibility, character, or the truthfulness of her claim that she spent the night with Mr. Gideon. They have no evidence contradictory of that other than, and the state likes to point out, some guy on the scene who knew Mr. Gideon who came forward and said something. Well, the television was correct in its analysis. He was, from their perspective, a rival drug dealer who had credibility issues himself, and he didn't render the evidence overwhelming because had the state's evidence been overwhelming, Mr. Gideon would have been convicted of murder. He was not. He was acquitted of murder in this particular case, despite confessions and all of the other evidence that the state seeks to cast as overwhelming. But it was not sufficiently overwhelming, even with him having got on the witness stand and testified to a confession which he recanted, I guess, on the witness stand. Despite all that, the state could not convict him of a murder. Now, and perhaps what you might call the equivocal nature of the jury verdict in this case had something to do with the fact that on cross-examination, he testified, I was with my girlfriend all night. And perhaps the juror said, well, because there's other aspects of the case that were perhaps weak. And the jury saw this, and that may be the reason why the verdicts as to the murder counts were different. But my position, notwithstanding all of the claims about the state that you'll eradicate this, you'll eradicate that, you'll make it easier for guys to skirt around the second prong if you don't do this and that. What is significant here is it's been my perspective, and I've been making this argument in my head and whenever I can for, I suppose, 30 years, that when you get into this context of prejudice and whether or not the prong has been met, courts, when confronted with evidence, they have to make decisions, to weigh decisions relative to outcome determination and that sort of thing. It's not my comprehension that judges to say, well, they didn't persuade me. If I was a juror, I would not have believed it. I don't think that's the test. I think the test is the test set forth in the most recent Appellate Division opinion, and that is if the evidence is sufficiently, let's say, credible, has sufficient integrity, that a jury should hear it, a jury should make a determination with respect to whether or not the outcome would have been different. And in this particular case, I say it would, and I'll say it one more time, because in modern-day America, it is particularly significant to what you might call in our system, the way particular witnesses are viewed. Had Ms. Bay been a college-educated woman from the suburbs, I suppose, we all understand that there has been some difference in the evaluation of her testimony as opposed to the posture that we find her. And as I indicated before, what is significant in this case, you have to strip oneself of these conceptions that somehow if a person is not an impeccable citizen, and she has no prior record, she's a working lady, that sort of stuff. If a person doesn't have a certain pedigree, then they have a lesser opportunity to underpin a reversal of a bad decision. And Ms. Bay, as I said, Judge Natale, the only judge in this case, and there have been many judges in this case, I counted maybe 10, Judge Natale, And let me backtrack a bit because it's significant. Mr. Yamatov and Ms. Ashashua, when they say PCR court, they talk about Judge Polanski. And I think earlier I heard one of the justices ask where certain decisions had been made on a cold record by the television. Judge Polanski didn't.
Mr. Bowman.
Yes.
Did I hear you say twice now that Judge Natal was the only judge you heard from Ms. Bay and Ms. Gideon Nichols? Because I believe the record shows that it was Judge Polanski who heard them both testify during the second PCR, sir.
No, I was there, Judge. No,
there was
Judge
no Polanski testimony during the second PCR, sir?
No, he never heard the witnesses. And that's in our brief. He never heard the witnesses, never met them. He did it on a cold record and basically split Judge the same finding that Judge Natal used to make a determination that it was necessary in this case that the jury make the decision. He flipped Judge Natal's finding. He never met Ms. Bay, never had any. I was the lawyer, Judge.
Mr. Bowman, my question to you is, did Judge Natal ever address prong number two of Strickland? Did he ever make a finding that there was a reasonable probability but for defense counsel's unprofessional error, and that is failure to speak with Ms. Bay after her name was mentioned on cross, the result of the proceedings would have been different? That is, did he ever make a finding that if Ms. Bay had testified, there's a reasonable probability that the jury would have acquitted your client? Did he ever address that?
Yes, I think he did, but I think he did it in different language. I think it was in his own.
Well, if you think he did it in a different way, but that he did it, then quote to us exactly what he said that you believe addressed prong number two.
I quoted for you. He basically said, and let me give a little background with respect to Mr. Gamber.
Well, let's quote him.
Well,
go ahead and quote the language that he used to address prong number two.
He said, this is the language that Judge Natal used that I interpret as covering the second prong of Strickland. He says that Mr. Gambert deprived his client of having a jury consider the possible testimony of his alibi witnesses to support his claim of innocence and that he was home that night with his girlfriend. Essentially what Judge Natal saw as the deprivation. As I indicated before, there are two ways.
That's Mr. Bowman, that's different. That's deficiency. Depriving the jury of hearing Ms. Bay is one thing. Whether Ms. Bay would have undermined the confidence of the jury in its determination to find guilt, that's something different. That's entirely different. Do you disagree with me?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I do. But I understand your position has a little more authority than mine. But yes, I do. I believe that basically what the judge, and I'll say it one more time because this is significant and it never came out in the presentations made by either of the prosecutors. Judge Natal is the only judge in this case who met Ms. Bay and who could evaluate her credibility in person as to whether what effect she might have on a jury. And his findings and his decision wasn't the most artful, particularly in terms of my intended use of it to make certain arguments for my client. But he decided that Ms. Bay's testimony had some significance and that a jury should not have been deprived of that. Let's assume that Your Honor, and Your Honor is correct that he didn't use what you might call traditional second prong language, and let's say that's true. The matter has been up and down since then in the most recent decision of the appellate division criticized by Ms. Sashua and Mr. Yamtov as creating, as eliminating second prong. I don't see it that way, or as a usurping by the appellate division of the authority of a trial court relative to make this decision. If we assume that Judge Natal didn't make that decision, we go to the next step. It went to the appellate division. Television remanded it back. Judge Natale had been sick, so Judge Polanski took over. Didn't interview any of the witnesses or anything like that. And based on Judge Natale's findings that Judge Natale had used to find that the PCR grant was appropriate, decided, no, these witnesses are incredible. Nobody's ever going to believe them, I don't believe them entitled to relief. Now, let's take it back up to
Mr. Bowman, I wanted to ask you a question about the appellate division decision, because you argued before about the level of credibility and how to assess that. The Aptiv, at a few places in the opinion, focuses on whether the testimony, quote, relates directly to a critical question or a fundamental point here where the defendant was at the time of the shooting. Are you familiar with the jury charge, false in one, false in all?
Yes, I'm familiar with that. I think we all are in practice.
So to get that charge, do you need to show that the falsity related to a critical question or a fundamental point, or does it simply turn on whether there was false testimony relating to a material fact?
Well, I think that Ms. Bay, if we're talking about Ms. Bay, as the way you might call it, the target of
I'm just talking about the principle at large, and then we'll come to the facts.
There's a certain principle associated with it, but in practice, I find that particular admonition or jury instruction, in terms of its application and when it's given and when it's not, is relatively uneven. But very rarely do courts refuse to give that charge if there appears to be inconsistent statements by a particular witness in a trial that are material. So I think
right.
That, yes,
Here's the language. I'm looking at the charge, and it relates to knowing or willful false testimony as to a material fact with intent to deceive. Should the concept be any different when it turns to the PCR phase of the case? Should we be talking about materiality or about whether a statement went to a fundamental or critical point of the case in the court's evaluation?
I tell you what I think I'm failing to understand is, if Your Honor is attempting to apply this false in one, false in all to Ms. Bay, because there's no falsity in her testimony, and the government has not indicated any whatsoever.
I'll tell you what I'm trying to do. I'm not hiding the ball here. I'm trying to get your help on what the appropriate legal standard should be, because we have an appellate division decision that seems to be focused on fundamental aspects of the testimony as opposed to simply whether something is material. So I'll come to the facts for you. Is it material, in your judgment, that the defendant said, I was home with one person, and Ms. Bay said, I was home with the defendant and a third person as well? Is that a material fact?
I think that the material fact in this particular case, as articulated by the television and what you might call adopted by me, is whether or not Ms. Bay, in her testimony, established the fundamental point that their testimony was consistent, the two of them, that they were at the mother's house together. Now, with respect to whether or not there's, scissors, so to speak, relative to other aspects of it, I understand what Your Honor means, but I don't believe that there was any fundamental fact or materiality of anything that denigrates what you might call the power of Ms. Bay's opportunity to testify and acquit this defendant, and I think Judge Natale saw that. Now, and I also believe it's very difficult.
Mr. Bowman, let me ask you a question, which is kind of a play on a theme of what the Chief Justice asked you, but I'm going to change the facts a little bit. Let's say Ms. Bay had said, oh, yeah, I was with a defendant in the apartment with 15 other people, okay, and we were having a big party all night long. We were all together. And the defendant said, oh, no, I was just there with my girlfriend. Would you think that would be a problem? Or is your position that so long as Ms. Bay and the defendant agree on the fact that the two of them were at home together, that's all that matters, and that's what would persuade a jury?
I don't think that it's necessarily all that matters, but I think also with respect to the two witnesses, the mother and Ms. Bay, I think there was some confusion with respect to whether or not they believed the mother was downstairs. The mother said she went to work. But there's no equivocation and no damage done to Ms. Bay. And the critical aspect in this case is that the defendant was home with her.
Have an address my hypothetical. In my hypothetical, is that different? Would you come to the same conclusion under my hypothetical?
Miss Bay
saying, we're all at home, big party, 15 people, defendant's there, and the defendant testifies, oh no, I was just home with Miss Bay. No one else was there.
Is your position the same? No, obviously not. I think that would be a different situation than what we got in this particular case, much different. And as I indicated before, Ms. Bay,
Why is it different? The defendant said that the mother went to work, and Ms. Bay said, oh, no, she was cooking, we were watching television, we were all sitting on the couch together. Why is that different?
I think the hypothetical I gave you. That was early in the night before Mr. Gideon and Ms. Bay retired. Ms. Bay was ill that evening, as I understand it, and there was some decision that had to be made whether or not to take her to the hospital because she was pregnant. And at some point, her and Mr. Gideon retired to the upstairs, and what happened thereafter is different. But nobody, nothing in this case contradicts Ms. Bay's concept that she was home with the baby. I'll put it this way. And what it felt like, I think, was very significant. And oftentimes, in criminal cases, as a defense lawyer, the government puts on witnesses who are inconsistent. And you routinely, in summation, when they're attacked, in summation from cross-examination, the government says, we take our witnesses as we find them, and no witnesses are perfect. And it's a different kind of standard. It isn't held against those people the same way in a circumstance like this. It's bad because of her relationship with Mr. Gideon, who is telling the truth. And there's no indication otherwise. As I said, there's some, I don't want to say bias in our system that makes it different when it's somebody like Ms. Bay than somebody else. And let me just talk a little bit about
Can I ask you one question, Mr. Bowman, before you go on to the next set of facts? How do you deal with the question which the second PCR court relied on to some extent, that Ms. Bay waited 5 years, notwithstanding having been at trial, heard the testimony, waited 5 years to provide the information that trial counsel said he was never given, despite numerous meetings with the witnesses and the defendant? And secondly... And secondly, I hate to mix them up, but the facts that you added to that they were upstairs, she was downstairs cooking, and all of that, it heightens the inconsistency between Ms. Bay's testimony and defendant's statement, doesn't it? So deal with the 5 years first.
I didn't add those, but I'll deal with the first 5 years first. The defendant testified in the trial that he was home with his girlfriend. Mr. Gambert sat there, and the government has conceded the first prong of Strickland because he didn't investigate at that time. He didn't say, just have a recess and go speak to this woman and see whether she's telling the truth or not. That was in real time during the trial, not 5 years later. He sat there, he heard that. He did nothing.
I was referring to his statement, but go ahead.
I understand. In his statement also, which is also, I think, excuse me, I just have a little fold, which I think is misstated. Mr. Gambert, at the PCR hearing, said he could not basically affirm or deny whether he'd been told about the witnesses or not. And he didn't remember, but it was been his practice had he been told to send an investigator out. But he never said I was never told, and I asked that particular question about that. He could not, and it's at page 35 of our supplemental brief. Mr. Gammer could not deny to General Berman that he was advised of LL alibi evidence prior to trial. He testified his failure to introduce alibi evidence was not a strategic decision. As I indicated before, his only statement relative to him having not been told was that he believed that had he been told, he would have sent an investigator out. Now, that's contradicted by the fact finder. When he heard in a murder trial, the defendant testifies, I was with my girlfriend. And you sit there, you don't do anything, you don't ask for an adjournment. You don't even try to talk to the woman at that particular time, in real time. And then the defendant shuffles off to the next lawyer. He says, I told Mr. Gambert I had witnesses. Gambert says, whatever, if it's 5 years later at that point, it's not that Ms. Bay didn't come forward. She was in court. And this is another point. It's irrefutable that she was in court at the time that he testified and was there available to be investigated on that day. So when I hear a lot of things I hear in this case, I don't know, are rather troubling. Things like that, when you understand that she was in court, they don't refute it. Mr. Gammer doesn't refute it. PCR report doesn't refute it. Why is it significant that it took 5 years from the district court? It didn't take 5 years to make her available. Nobody took advantage of the opportunity. And I'm speaking about the counsel. And they must, and that is the reason why the government conceded the first prong, because the lawyer sat there and did nothing.
Justice Pierluigi.
I was going to ask a similar question as Justice Solomon with regard to Ms. Bay and her not coming forward, and the fact that it seems that that cuts against her credibility. Is there any indication, Mr. Bowman, that she spoke to the lawyer about her alibi testimony and the fact that she was with, that she claimed she was with the defendant on the night of the shooting?
Well, as I indicated before, focus at the PCR hearing, and the mother testified, but the mother's a different story, and they're not Siamese twins. But there's this indication in what this case is about is Ms. Bay was in court with this lawyer at the time that the defendant testified that he was home with her. She was in court. She was available at that point. The lawyer didn't lean over and say, is that true? Is she available? He did nothing. So you say, well, so you concede the first prong of Strickland there, but with respect to the fact that the PCR didn't get filed for 5 years, you want to hold that against her. But you don't hold it against the woman or hold it against the government or the system. And nothing happened that day. They were in trial. And I tell you something else.
But that's what you're concentrating on the deficiency prong. The question is, okay, if he spoke with her and put her on the stand and she testified to what she testified to in the PCR hearing, would the is there a reasonable probability that the jury would have acquitted her? And you're saying acquitted the defendant. And you're saying yes.
I'm saying absolutely, Your Honor, because it would have been impossible for him to be with her and someplace involved in the criminality that is alleged in this particular case. I would say absolutely. And then I'll say it one more time. It was significant in this case. The only judge who met Ms. Bay decided there was an ineffective assistance claim. Ineffective assistance counsel claim made out, and that this guy was entitled to have this evidence presented to a jury because if the jury believed it, he would have got acquitted. And it's nothing changed.
Judge Nuttall never said that. He just go ahead. Justice Pierluigi. No, go ahead.
Mr. Bowman, so even in light of defendant's very detailed statement, in light of the fact that there was an eyewitness that put him at the scene, you believe that Ms. Bay's testimony alone would have absolutely led to his acquittal?
Yeah, she matches up well with this so-called eyewitness in terms of if you want to evaluate both of those persons for their credibility. She matches up very well as against him, without doubt. Now, also,
well, didn't the eyewitnesses' statement with regard to what took place in the alleyway corroborate defendant's own statement with regard to the fact that he was there with two other individuals all dressed in black? The eyewitness says the exact same thing, that he saw prior to the shooting three individuals all dressed in black in the alleyway with firearms.
There's also
their statements are consistent with each other, correct?
There's another interesting aside to this particular case. The defendant basically testified that he fabricated the confession because he was being coerced by the government. And they told him he could go home if he had assent to telling this mistruth about having been involved, and that happened to be consistent with this so-called eyewitness. Now, 20, 30 years ago, there were routine, what you might call, claims of coercion of confessions in this kind of context. And in modern day, the particular city or county in which this arises, the police department there has been what you might call radically modified because of those. This era was rife with corruption, and not money corruption, but corruption with coercing false confessions out of people and that sort of thing. And nobody mentions that. And that's why defense lawyers sometimes feel, I don't know, lonely because there's this standard when you're talking about law enforcement. They're pristine. And when you're talking about somebody who's not law enforcement, that there's a natural gap or a natural entitlement to credibility that law enforcement has. Now, I'm going to say something else, too, that is significant. And it's a shame, and I'm a black man, but routinely I have to revert to what you might call analysis of racial issues in particular cases like this. And years ago, and every time that this court has commissioned a study, whether it's sentence disparity or whatever, or the institutionalized training relative to the falsifying complaints for arrest people on the Turnpike and Garden State Parkway. The court always finds some systemic racism, and particularly when you talk about the Parkway case and hundreds of thousands of people who were stopped on false pretenses, who ultimately went and had suppression motions in courts throughout the state, throughout New Jersey, and the police officers were deemed to be credible. 80-90% of those particular circumstances where they were not being truthful. So what I'm saying in this case, what is significant to me in terms of the people involved in this argument, the only two people who have met Ms. Bay, myself and Judge Natal, and Ms. Bay stands up head and shoulders above this so-called eyewitness, head and shoulders in terms of credibility, lifestyle, and any other aspect. And that's in there. And when you decide this case,
Mr. Bowman, I don't understand something. You started out by saying that Judge Natal was disparaging the witnesses, which included Ms. Bay. Apparently disparaging her, I think, equates to what not believing her, but he came to the decision that she should have been permitted to testify. So it doesn't seem to me that Judge Natal was putting his mark of approval on her credibility. Am I mistaken about that?
What he was doing was saying, I have some qualms about these particular witnesses, but it's not my role to disqualify them because I particularly don't believe them. We're in a circumstance where if she's believed by the jury and there's no contradiction of her claim that she was there all night with her boyfriend. If she's believed by a jury, he'll get acquitted. And I shouldn't supplant my judgment for the judgment of a jury in this particular circumstance. And whatever I might feel about these witnesses, the evidence is sufficient that a jury should hear it, and therein lies the violation. The defense counsel did not effectuate that.
But I think he concluded that she contradicted the defense. And that's why he reached this conclusion.
But
that's a lot different than what you're talking.
Throughout this argument, both prosecutors talk about the Ms. Bay and Ms. Gidding as if they're Siamese twins.
So contradicted the defendant. She contradicted the defendant. And I thought that's what Judge Natal was concerned with.
Ms. Bay did not contradict the defendant. The mother may have, but the mother wouldn't have been called as a witness if that was true. The two people were not tethered together.
Okay, that's not how I remember the defendant's statement, but okay.
Mr. Bowman, you made a comment. I wanted to ask you about it in addressing the reasonable probability on the second prong, you said that this jury verdict was equivocal, and of course, you know, I think the court is always reluctant to speculate as to what jury verdicts mean, because the defendant was acquitted of murder and convicted of manslaughter. And you indicated that shows that they may have, or to some degree, believed your client's alibi. But if his alibi were to be believed, he couldn't have been convicted of manslaughter or murder because he wouldn't have been there. So why does it help you that there was a lesser included offense of manslaughter as to which he was convicted that really is inconsistent with his alibi?
Well, two reasons, Judge. First of all, he didn't get to present his alibi witness. Had Ms. Bay been there, we believe that the verdicts would have been different altogether.
Okay, gotcha on that. I understand that argument, but why is the jury's determination to convict him of a lesser included offense of manslaughter, which required, I assume, that the jury conclude he was on the scene and not home with his girlfriend, have anything to do with this?
Because if the evidence was over, the facts of this case as depicted by the government in its proofs and with its so-called eyewitness, make out a scenario that if proved would have led to murder convictions. And they said evidence is overwhelming. If the evidence is so overwhelming, even in the absence of his alibi, why didn't he get convicted of murder?
The evidence is overwhelming, I think I'm reading their briefs and hearing their arguments to mean the evidence is overwhelming that he was present at the shooting and took part in the shooting. Whether it's manslaughter or it's first degree murder is another story.
Why did he get convicted of murder, Judge? If he was an accomplice to murder, you get convicted. If your evidence is overwhelming, there was some doubt, obviously, in the jurors' minds with respect to the account set forth by the government, and it's obviously so. And it's our perspective that to eradicate this concept, the overwhelming evidence that this alibi defense would have had a very.
It has nothing, Mr. Bowman, it has nothing to do. I don't see how that. And this is what Justice Patterson is saying. I don't see what that has to do with the alibi. The jury could have found that because he wasn't the shooter, he didn't have the same mens rea, and decided based upon the reasonable doubt standard to give him the benefit of the doubt and convicted of manslaughter. I don't understand what that has to do with the alibi defense.
Well, Judge, the alibi defense would have strengthened the defendant's position of non-culpability. Now, there's no doubt about that. That the alibi defense with Ms. Bay as the witness would have had a substantial positive effect on the defense in this case. And to the extent that Your Honor indicated that there are other reasons perhaps why he didn't get convicted, or I concur in that completely. It's impossible ordinarily to determine exactly why a particular jury verdict is what it is. But it is not impossible to say here that the evidence was not overwhelming relative to the government's theory.
Mr. Bowman, I think we have your position. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Ms. Shashua, did you want to offer brief rebuttal?
Unless the court has any questions, we'd ask this court to reverse.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.